You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, are we moments away from a bailout for Cyprus? As the banks plead with the Parliament to step in, we'll get the latest.
Business is nearly dead. Nearly. We have some customers. We are trying to receive cash, but it's very bad.
Also ahead, following the death of Chinua Achebe, we look back at the life and works of one of the driving forces of African literature.
I think what was great about Achebe was he spoke about difficult things in a very simple, pared-down style, which made you realise the contradictions of contemporary African experience in a way.
We'll hear more from Jeremy Wheat later on, and we'll also head to New York to admire the antiques of Dienst and Dotter.
The connection of minimalism and the pared-down simplicity and purity of Scandinavian antiques, but also culture, is what interests me on a level that it moves my soul, truly.
All that, plus we'll go through some of the liveliest stories from the world this week, and we'll play you some great music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up with the latest world news now with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The coming hours are expected to decide the economic fate of Cyprus as it struggles to meet the terms of an international financial bailout. Government spokesman Christos Stylianides said every solution involved some degree of pain, but he refrained from giving any details. The Cypriot Parliament will debate plans to raise the 5.8 billion euros needed to qualify for the 10 billion euro bailout, having rejected an earlier deal. Takis Fidias of the Cyprus Popular Bank described the current proposals being considered.
The proposals at the moment are to create a good bank from Laiki Bank by transferring all the deposits up to 100,000 and the good assets of the bank in Cyprus, while at the same time the branches of all Cyprus banks in Greece will be saved by the Greek government coming to an agreement to transfer these branches to a Greek bank.
The United Nations has given its investigators another year to gather evidence of war crimes in Syria, saying they'd already found horrifying first-hand accounts of murder, torture and rape. The UN Human Rights Council condemned gross violations by Syrian government forces and allied militia, including shelling of populated areas and massacres during the two-year conflict. Ireland's ambassador to the UN, Gerard Corr, speaks on behalf of the European Union.
While the Syrian authorities have failed to prosecute alleged perpetrators, the international community must ensure that impunity will not prevail. The resolution before us notes that all those responsible for human rights violations and abuses must be held accountable and recognises the relevance of international criminal justice.
The Italian President Giorgio Napolitano has asked centre-left leader Pierluigi Bersani to see if he has enough support to form a government and to report back to the head of state as soon as possible. Because the centre-left had won the most seats in Parliament in last month's election, Mr. Napolitano said he had asked Bersani to verify that he had a secure majority that could win confidence votes in both Houses of Parliament. Mr. Bersani said he would seek to form a reform-minded government with the maximum balance and determination. The Chinese leader Xi Jinping has demonstrated the importance of Beijing's growing ties with Russia by going to Moscow on his first foreign trip as president. Mr. Xi's choice of destination sent a signal to the United States that the world's largest energy producer, Russia, and its biggest consumer, China, want to bolster their joint clout as a financial and geopolitical counterweight to Washington. Pope Francis has urged the West to intensify dialogue with Islam and has appealed to the world to do more to combat poverty and protect the environment. Speaking in Italian, the new pontiff said richer countries should fight what he called the spiritual poverty of our times by reforging links with God. However, some critics of the Catholic Church, which has been struggling with scandals and internal divisions, say its rejection of contraception in particular harms the poor. The Nigerian author Shinua Achebe has died at the age of 82 after a brief illness. A statement from his family said his wisdom and courage were an inspiration to all who knew him. One of Africa's best-known authors, his 1958 debut novel, Things Fall Apart, which dealt with the impact of colonialism in Africa, has sold more than 10 million copies. Speaking in 2007, he tried to identify his motivation for writing.
It feels good to be acknowledged at any time. I say this, I hope it applies to other writers, but as far as I'm concerned, I write to be read, to be acknowledged. In other words, it means what I've written has made some impact somewhere.
The author Shinua Achebe, who has died. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. James will be back in a little under half an hour to bring us a quick roundup of what's happening around the world. But in the meantime, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Now, could we be moments away from a bailout deal for Cyprus? Employees of the country's banks, closed now for almost a week, have been rallying outside Parliament all day. Behind closed doors, President Anastasiades has been talking to the troika of the ECB, the IMF and the European Commission about altering the terms of the bailout. Meanwhile, also behind closed doors, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has been expressing her frustration that Cyprus doesn't seem to be acting decisively enough. Well, in a moment, we'll be talking to Dr. James Kerr-Lindsay. He's Senior Research Fellow in Southeast European Politics at the London School of Economics. But first, let's get the word from Nicosia. We sent our reporter, Natalie Savarakis, out to gauge how business in Cyprus is being affected.
How are you surviving these days? How is business going?
Business is nearly dead. Nearly. We have some customers. We are trying to receive cash, but it's very bad.
Do you accept credit cards any longer?
No.
Why not?
Just now I had a customer. He had a credit card from Argentina. I told him, I'm sorry, you have to wait until next week. We are waiting to see what's going to be happening next week. Nothing is sure.
What do you think will happen on Tuesday when the banks open?
I don't want to think what's going to happen. I am thinking that everybody, they will wait from 6 o'clock to the banks open to take money, not to put money, to save money. This is, forget that one, this. We want money, we need cash. And the banks, they are not willing to give money. I don't know what it's going to be after that.
Natalie Savarakis talking to businesses out in Cyprus earlier on today. To help us better understand the latest, I'm joined on the line by Dr. James Kerr-Lindsay from the London School of Economics. Welcome, James. It has been a very busy day in terms of what proposals could or could not be accepted. There is clearly a race against time here, but where are we up to now?
You know, nobody really has a clear idea at this stage of what's been put on the table. I mean, it has been an absolutely incredible day, and all sorts of news has been flying around. I think the most important factor, you know, was the early stage news in the day, which is that Russia hasn't come to the save Cyprus. This was an idea that was, been floating around, that somehow Moscow was going to come in. The Russian finance minister very early on in the day said, look, you know, we've looked at everything, we've looked at all the proposals, you know, the Cypriots have given us for buying into the banks, on the energy, we're just not interested. So the Cyprus finance minister has flown back and they've spent the rest of the day trying to sort something out. And yes, you're absolutely right, it is a race against time, but nobody's, any the wiser about where we stand at the moment.
What seems to be happening, though, if you're watching the day's events, is that little tidbits of a possible deal seem to be released to the public. There's always the levy on bank deposits, which keeps coming back and back and back, despite the fact that it was rejected a couple of days ago by the Cypriot Parliament. But then as soon as an idea comes out, you get comment from Germany, from Luxembourg, from Brussels going, no, not good enough, go back, think of something else and think of something else quickly?
Absolutely. I mean, this is exactly the problem. And, you know, I was speaking a little earlier with an economist based on the island who was sort of saying to me, look, you know, the sheer fact of the matter is that Cyprus desperately needs technical assistance. You know, there are some very, very talented people on the island, but, you know, this is just way beyond anything they've ever had to deal with. And I think, you know, there is a very good case to be said for saying, can you get some sort of expertise in there? The problem is, you know, we've seen after 6 days of this, there isn't the time now to sort of be putting together good, solid plans. I think it's just trying to cobble anything together, something together, which will allow this crisis to come to an end, or at least move into the next phase, because this is by no means at an end, and it's not going to be for a very, very long time. There's going to be very significant fallout for the Cyprus economy.
Not just for the Cypriot economy, but for pretty much the rest of the euro. You mentioned a moment ago the fact that Russia didn't come good. In fact, I understand that Russia has basically said we might be able to help, but once the EU bailout deal has been sorted out, and they're obviously waiting to see. One idea I did see being bandied around was the Cypriot banks actually putting a stronger levy on foreign deposits, such as Russian deposits and British deposits, in order to protect the people of Cyprus, who may be earning and saving considerably less than the foreign investors, and yet sending a very sharp sort of pro-euro message out to the people who've got their cash deposited there. What are your thoughts on that idea?
Well, you know, how strange this whole situation is, that they rejected an earlier deal which would have kept would have kept the depositors there. I think maybe the fact is that they've woken up to the fact that this has been so badly handled that the chances there are that a lot of the foreign depositors are going to get their money out now anyway. Might as well take as much money as possible from them before they go. And so we've seen a complete reversal over the course of the week of attitudes on this, because, of course, you know, at the start of the week, part of the issue was that the Cyprus government wanted to keep the levy on foreign depositors as low as possible, but below 10% as a psychological sort of threshold by which, you know, as many of those depositors would have stayed. So they would have taken their tax and they'd say, all right, OK, it's a one-off and we'll stay. But because of the way that this has been handled in actual fact, and it's becoming more costly every day that's passed, you know, because of the effects that this is having on the banks and the forecast now on the Cyprus economy, that they're now having to talk, yes, you're right, higher figures. I mean, I think the latest figure that has been bandied around is 15%. So, you know, that's significantly higher. And I just get the sense that, you know, the calculation has been made that the Cyprus economy is going to be decimated because of what's taken place over this past week. And yes, perhaps, you know, this is a chance, have to just get as much money as possible and hope to salvage the situation some way or another.
To what degree, however, is the Russian question fundamental to the agreement by the Troika to give the bailout money? I read somewhere that Angela Merkel has said that she wants to keep Cyprus in the Eurozone to preserve the strength of the Eurozone, but Cyprus has to learn that it can no longer be the offshore financial centre for wealthy Russians.
Well, I mean, you know, this comes back to the fundamental point in all of this. This crisis has also been caused by the fact that Germany has absolutely stubbornly clung to this idea that somehow Cyprus is the center of all Russian international money laundering. I mean, it's a complete fallacy. Yes, it had problems in the 1990s, but it had cleaned up its act. And yes, there was still some dirty Russian money going through Cyprus, but if you look at the sorts of deposits as a percentage of the overall Russian economy, it was tiny. And not only that, but, you know, the argument has been made time and time again. Hold on, and there isn't dirty Russian money swilling around London these days. There isn't dirty Russian money swilling around most of the European capitals. No, I mean, you know, this is part of the problem, that, you know, because Germany was so determined to crack down on Cyprus over this, that it actually said, right, OK, we aren't going to go down a different route that we've proposed for other countries. No, the Cypriots have got to take responsibility for their own actions, so we're going to put this levy, you know, in place, and this will either hit the Russians or it'll hit the Cypriots and teach them a lesson. You know, so in fact, you know, what the Cypriot MPs did on Monday night was monumentally stupid, but what Germany has done has also been monumentally stupid. You know, everyone comes out really, really badly from this whole affair.
Dr. James Kerr-Lindsay, Senior Research Fellow in Southeast European Politics at the London School of Economics, many thanks for your time.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the global pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, the Nigerian writer, scholar and giant of African literature, Chinua Achebe, has today died at the age of 82. In the eyes of Nelson Mandela, he brought Africa to the rest of the world, a freedom fighter in whose company the prison walls fell down. Achebe's work stretched back to his first book, 1958's And Things Fall Apart. And by marrying African rhythms and oral traditions with his stark English prose, Achebe focused on how the continent of Africa adjusted to a state of post-colonialism in the 20th century. Here he is remembered by Jeremy Wheat, founder of the Abuja-based publishing house Cassava Republic, in conversation with Monocle's producer Alid John.
How can we measure his impact across the African continent, or indeed the literary world?
You know, in the wake of his death today, a lot of phrases have been thrown up on social media and elsewhere about him being the father of African literature. Perhaps that's true. I mean, I would say at the very least he's a dominant influence in contemporary African literature. I'd always like to place him in the context of many other writers as well. For instance, Amos Tutuola, another Nigerian writer, wrote a book, The Palm Wine Drinkers, in 1952, which was several years before Things Fall Apart. And you can talk about writers from North, South, East and West Africa who are more or less of the same generation. But I think, yes, it's true to say that Chinua Achebe stands slightly ahead of them for two reasons, I think. Partly because of Things Fall Apart and its seminal influence. You know, it's a set text in so many parts of the world. But also, I think, secondly, because of his involvement in the African Writers series. So he was the founding editor of the African Writers series, which was published by Heinemann. And so many of the famous African writers that we know today became famous precisely because of the African Writers series and his editorship. So I think it's these two factors of him writing this initial, his first book, and also his involvement, close involvement with the African Writers series, which put him, you know, sort of in the lead position as the most important writer on the continent, certainly of the 20th century.
Nelson Mandela was on record having said that Chinua Achebe brought Africa to the world. I wonder perhaps the content of Things Fall Apart, a study of an Igbo tribal leader, Okonkwo, who resisted colonialism to an extent, the tragic element being that he paid for it with his death. Is there a sense that Chinua Achebe's works focus on the kind of adjustment that Africa went through in the 20th century, both during colonialism and post-colonialism?
Yeah, I mean, today I've been thinking a lot about his final book, There Was a Country, which is a difficult book to read. It speaks of very personal experience. It's very direct in places. And there's a particular point in the book where he talks about realizing that Lagos, where he was living, he was working for the Nigerian Broadcasting Company, he realized that Lagos was no longer home. And for me, that was a really poignant moment because up until that point, I think Achebe, you know, felt Nigerian and felt Lagos was his home. And then when he realized he was being hounded and there were people trying to get him and he had to sort of secrete himself outside of Lagos and go back east. I think he was tragically affected to the end of his days by that experience. And really, you know, sort of you can follow a trajectory from things fall apart and colonial experience. Definitely he had an ambivalent relationship to colonialism, which comes out in the final book. But all the way from Things Fall Apart to the final book, There Was a Country. I think what was great about Achebe was he spoke about difficult things in a very simple, pared-down style, which made you realize the contradictions of contemporary African experience in a way. For instance, in There Was a Country, on the one hand, he talks, you know, he clearly has a debt of gratitude to, you know, the colonial education system on the one hand. But on the other hand, he remained furious about the British role in Biafra and Western powers' role in Biafra in general. So I think he went to sleep yesterday having revealed uncomfortable truths. It's not like you can look at him, maybe, you know, in comparison to Mandela, where we now see Mandela as, you know, this sort of great grandfather figure who's kind of, you know, resolved, and there's a certain amount of grace around his figure. I think Achebe went into the night, you know, full of passion and full of unresolved conflicts that will remain with us to read and digest in the years to come.
Jeremy Wheat, founder of the Abuja-based publishing house Cassava Republic there. Listening to that was the African writer and journalist and Monocle regular, Belinda Otis. Welcome to the show, Belinda. How much do you think Achebe was an influence, not just on your writing, but on the whole of Africa?
Oh, wow. I can't even begin to measure that. I mean, you still get young writers who are coming through the ranks who want to write like he, you know, he used to write. I mean, it's a little bit funny to now speak about him in the past tense, to be honest. I'm trying to get my head around it. He's one of those people you think will always be around. But his influence on writers, you cannot measure it. I mean, the likes of Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who today is hailed as one of Africa's foremost literary voice. You know, she has spoken about his influence on her life and her writing and her reading his book, you know, helped her to realize that actually you can write about Africans, we can write about ourselves and write our own stories. And even today, like Jeremy pointed out in that report, you know, you have people on social media talking about him. And there's a particular status update I read where someone wrote, Chinua Achebe made me realize I could write about myself and we could write about Africans. So in that regard, you cannot even begin to measure the shift, the paradigm shift that occurred with Things Fall Apart. It was like a door opened and Africans all over realized we have stories to tell and we can talk about ourselves in the way we want to, how we want to tell it, without apologizing for it.
His writing style was incredibly stark and simple and straightforward, yet it brought in African rhythms. How important do you think that decision was to write in it, to write Things Fall Apart in English was?
You know, I think that's a question that he would have been the best person to answer, but I will do my best to say for him to write Things Fall Apart in English probably was a decision he made so that more people could read it, because, you know, as of then, you know, I'm still very young, so I don't know if you had people who could translate Igbo into English at that point. How many people would the book have reached if he had been written in Igbo? You know, that's a whole different subject that, you know, we could talk about. But in this particular instance, in response to your question, I think the fact that he wrote Things Fall Apart in English is a plus, because more people were able to read it, and to that effect it was later translated into over 40 languages with 10 million copies sold worldwide. I don't know if it would have had the same effect if it had been written in Igbo at that point, in comparison to now that translations are a little bit more practical and easier to get around. So I think writing in English, you know, was like a barrier breaker in that sense. He was able to reach more people, and he owned English language. In as much as English was his second language, there was this sense of ownership about the language. After all, you know, even now in Nigeria, people still have to learn English. You know, it's practically a first language for a whole lot of people alongside their mother tongue. So he owned the language, and he used the language to tell his own story the way he wanted to tell his story. He made it with his story. And I think that's why it became so accessible to many people from different countries, different traditions and cultures, to be able to relate to Things Fall Apart, because he was telling a story from the point of view of the Igbo people, yet there were universal themes that everyone and anyone could identify with.
Belinda, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, Belinda Otis, the writer and journalist remembering Chinua Achebe, who's died at the age of 82. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 25 minutes past the hour, and time for some music. Here's Horace Silver with Song for My Father. Horace Silver there on Monocle 24 and Song for My Father. The time is 26 minutes past the hour. You're with Midori House, and I'm joined in the studio by Robert Bound and Tom Edwards.
Hi, Emma.
Hello.
How's it going?
Very well, thank you.
You got a Friday feeling going on?
I've got a Friday wind up, actually, because I'm here for the daily. So I'm just getting my head down and just enjoying myself, gearing myself up for an evening
glad
of broadcasting.
To hear that.
Yeah, good to hear it. Gentlemen, how are you, though? Are you full of the Friday feeling? And are you full of the week's news, which you want to regurgitate towards us?
Friday feeling tick, Tom. Friday feeling tick for you?
Absolutely.
Tick in the box. Two ticks in the box.
Marvellous.
And we've got some news, too.
What's the news?
Do you want to kick off, Tom, or shall I?
Tom?
I think you should to get the ball rolling, Rob.
I wanted to talk about the Pope.
Don't we all?
I want to talk about the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury. A big, big week for religious leaders.
Yes.
Pot pickers.
Very good for outfit spotting.
Very good for outfits. And I wanted to talk about the way that the media has covered both of these appointments, actually. You're holding up the Times there, the Times of London. There's a picture of the new Archbishop of Canterbury, just a newbie on the front page. And there's lots of discussion about what his position means and and all the sort of minutiae of it, what it means for women and gay marriage and all the rest of it. There wasn't a lot of that about surrounding the Pope, which seemed to me a big love-in.
Well, there was a bit when he was first chosen.
Yeah.
I think there's a joke going around that, you know, how long would it take for a British member of the media to mention the Falklands and Pope Francis's involvement, you know, and I think it took about 20 seconds following the announcement of his election. I think quite a lot of people did the digging last week. And so this week it was all about getting him out there and making him set out his papal stall. What I find interesting is he's off to see Pope Emeritus Benedict later, which is going to be just the best conversation, because it's the first time that conversation has happened in, well, ever, I think, apart from once in about 600 years ago.
Are you saying that prayer doesn't work, and that just by being able to close your eyes, you can't speak to the former Pope?
You might not.
I know what you mean, though.
Such an immediate presence.
You might not get.
You might have to wait a
presence.
Bit. I don't know, but Tom.
I think there's an interesting question about perspective on all of this, and I think that's what Rob was alluding to. That there wasn't a great deal of dissent. Certainly, unsurprisingly, within the Vatican City, there were mainly aficionados and fans there, but there wasn't even much of an agenda to look at some of the big underlying problems that the Roman Catholic Church is facing. And I was rather surprised by that attack, particularly in the media, which, as we know, can occasionally be a little sceptical about these things.
In which I must have been reading completely different outlets, because all I got was, is Pope Francis, you know, did he hide, you know, how much did he not talk about his involvement in the junta? What's his, you know, the fact that he had a big argument with Christina Fernandez de Kirchner, his anti-abortion. Yeah, he's anti-abortion, isn't it? The anti-women in the church. I was just surrounded by that and completely missed the good stuff.
We've got sort of six TVs in upstairs on the editorial floor with rolling news channels, which are obviously famously useless. And all we saw was, nuns being interviewed
Pope.
About how happy they were and what this meant to them. It was the same sort of discourse as the first question you ask a 100-meter runner after he's just won a race. You know, how do you feel right now? And that was essentially it. And I thought it was a pretty poor show by the media.
I wonder whether, in actual fact, we have two new figures in the church who are perhaps slightly nicer, who bring a more promising future. I mean, we're just looking at the copy of today's Times of London. It says, "I am Justin, a jogging servant of Jesus Christ." There is a humanity to both men. There is a friendliness and approachability to both men. And there's a humility to both men, which, frankly, should be welcomed.
Yeah, that should be welcomed. I mean, and this is, and I'm not, as I say, this isn't, I wrote a column yesterday and it wasn't about... It was having a go at the media. The lack of interest in the media, perhaps, rather than how nice these two guys are at the top of their respective churches.
Tom, what else caught your eye this week in the media?
I've been very interested in following Obama's tour around Israel, obviously, and I think what's been particularly interesting is, again, to sort of take the media slant on this, to look at how people have reacted, in particular to his big sort of keynote speeches, the one where he implored particularly the younger generation within Israel not to sort of let their, you know, Zionist traditions go to waste, and to try and bring up the idea of having more empathy with their sort of cousins across the disputed borders. And I thought it was really interesting. In the US, that was, they sort of focused on this idea of him, this very statesman-like delivery, back to his best, one of his best speeches, the great oratory. But once again, they did say it was long on, you know, the sentiment, long on the rhetoric, and a little short on real detail. And I thought it was interesting how that compared to a lot of the criticisms of his whole first term, where that was a problem he faced again and again to a fairly hostile, certainly the right-wing elements in media in the States, that he was very good at the flowery delivery, very good at the grandstanding, but maybe there was a lack of substance. And I think on a debate as critical as the Middle East question, it'll be interesting to see whether he can deliver a bit more in the second term.
I know that there was an awful lot of commentary that immediately followed this great speech from Israel saying Obama is a politician that Israel needs. But there was also, I don't know if anybody saw a sort of a cynical piece saying that both Palestinians and Israelis were completely united and slapping each other on the back in their dismissal of the stupidity of Obama's speech and the fact that no one would ever get round to it. I mean, this was, of course, a parody. And they said then after they'd all slapped each other's backs, they all went off and started shelling each other. So
it's like the armistice. It's like the football game during the armistice, right, in the First World War.
Pretty much. And basically, Obama had united Israel and Palestine, but simply because in their dismissal of him. What did you think, Mr. Bound?
I think you got it spot on. And I guess you're right. I mean, at least, going back to an earlier point as well, there at least was much to be made in the media of this visit. I'd also like, finally, to say, while we're doing a news roundup of the week, isn't it nice to have David Bowie at number one in the album charts? That hasn't happened for 23 years. That's okay, isn't it, too?
Are you off to the V&A to see his costume?
Yeah, I missed the media. I missed the press thing this week, which is rather annoying. But hey, you can't always be on the radio. You can't be in two places at once. Unless maybe you are David Bowie.
He can have
a number of different personae.
Three or four places he can be in.
You should maybe think about that, Rob. Having a different personae for each week.
Oh, my God.
Or for something, or for each role that you have.
Bipolar Bobby.
Wearing... dressing up like David Bowie in his Thin White Duke period.
Indeed.
My God. Right, the time is just coming up to 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Edwards, our news editor, and Robert Bound, our culture editor, thank you both very much indeed for joining us in the studio. Stay with us, because in the next half hour of today's programme, we'll uncover the life of one of the Victorian era's most famous explorers, Paul du Chaillu, with the help of a new book. We'll trawl through the edits section of the new Monocle magazine with Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi, who's in New York. And staying in New York, we'll pay a trip to the antique store Dienst und Dotter. But first, with the time coming up to 35 minutes past the hour, a little late, here's James with the news headlines.
The coming hours are expected to decide the economic fate of Cyprus as it struggles to meet the terms of an international financial bailout. Government spokesman Christos Stylianides said every solution involved some degree of pain. The United Nations has given its investigators another year to gather evidence of war crimes in Syria, saying they had already found horrifying first-hand accounts of murder, torture and rape. The UN Human Rights Council condemned gross violations by Syrian government forces and allied militia, including shelling of populated areas and massacres during the two-year conflict. The Italian President Giorgio Napolitano has asked centre-left leader Pierluigi Bersani to see if he has enough support to form a government and to report back to the head of state as soon as possible. Because the centre-left had won the most seats in Parliament in last month's election, Mr. Napolitano said that he asked Bersani to verify that he had a secure majority and could win confidence votes in both houses of Parliament.
Chinese leader Xi Jinping has demonstrated the importance of Beijing's growing ties with Russia by going to Moscow on his first foreign trip as president. Mr. Xi's choice of destination sent a signal to the United States that the world's largest energy producer, Russia, and its biggest consumer, China, want to bolster their joint clout as a financial and geopolitical counterweight to Washington. And the Nigerian author Chinua Achebe has died at the age of 82 after a brief illness. A statement from his family said his wisdom and courage were an inspiration to all who knew him. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. James will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news before Marcus Hippie will be hosting this week's episode of The Menu. In the meantime, though, the time is 36 minutes to the hour. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Now, the mid-19th century was a period of great transformation. The world was opening up geographically and society was just about to be plunged into a profound reassessment of man's relationship with nature, religion and race. One man who took full advantage of this was Paul du Chaillu, a Franco-American explorer who's credited with the discovery of the gorilla. He's the subject of a new book by my next guest, the author Monty Reel, who joins me on the line now. A very warm welcome to the programme, Monty. Just before we ask you about why you decided to write about Paul du Chaillu, tell us a little bit more about the man.
Well, Paul du Chaillu is one of those figures who just kind of has fallen through the cracks of history. He was a guy who was really famous in his lifetime. In 1848, as a 17-year-old, he traveled to Gabon in West Africa to live with his father. And his father was a French trader, ran a trading station there. But instead of moving in with his father, he actually lived with an American missionary who was in Gabon. And this missionary happened to be the person who collected the first gorilla skull known to science. That had happened just a few months before du Chaillu moved in with him. So du Chaillu kind of came of age there in Gabon, and whenever he was in his early 20s, he decided to go into the interior of Africa to try to encounter gorillas, which at that time was an animal that was almost completely unknown to science. It had never been described in the wild. And so he undertook this sort of seat-of-the-pants expedition, just with no real backing, to go in essentially alone into equatorial Africa to try to encounter this animal that people really at that time didn't know much about.
There is something fascinating about the character, though, isn't he? Because he's a product of an era and of a geographical location, which means that he's a pioneer in terms of the fact that he's discovering the gorilla and sending information back to London about it. But at the same time, he is a part and parcel of the missionary world, and also he is a hunter. A lot of the remnants that we have, the artifacts that we have from Chaillu's time, is skulls of gorillas that he collected, that he shot and brought back.
Yeah, and skins. He actually, when he came out of the forest in 1859, he came out with about 20 gorilla skins, which he stuffed, and he brought them to New York first, to the to Broadway. He opened up, as kind of crazy as it sounds, he opened up kind of a showroom on Broadway to show these, and eventually he went to London. And that's where they really took off. It caused an absolute sensation. They called it gorilla fever. People just could not get enough of this new animal. And, of course, this was the time, the exact moment, when the evolution debate was really starting to be seriously discussed. And so imagine you have this period when people are really beginning to seriously debate whether people might have a kinship with apes, and all of a sudden there's this new ape that kind of bursts into the world consciousness. It created a huge sensation.
Looking at your book, you are a journalist by trade, but you've decided to recount this story in novel form. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, it is such a fascinating story with so much drama built into it. It's almost as if the story kind of, if you just tell it as it happened, it does kind of tell itself in a natural almost novelistic way. You have this young man who kind of decides in the beginning of the story that he's going to kind of reinvent himself. And he has no scientific backing at all or no scientific background when he goes into Gabon, and he encounters just incredible adventures. And then he stumbles straight into this evolution debate. It just kind of naturally flows as if it's a novel. And it can be told in a way that is, highly dramatic, but also, it's nonfiction.
What was it that drew you to Paul Duchaillou?
There were a couple of things. The very first thing was I had read a mention of him in a book by Richard Burton, Sir Richard Francis Burton, who the Victorian adventurer, geographer, linguist. He had gone on a trip to Gabon in 1861 and 1862 at the height of this guerrilla fever to try to see guerrillas himself. And I stumbled across that book and was reading it and came across Duchaillou's name and just started to do research about him because I just found his story, what little I knew of it, really interesting. But as I was doing that research, I found so many contradictions. I would look at one source and it would say he was born in Paris. And then I'd see another source and it would say he was born in New Orleans. Another one would say New York or South Carolina. All of those actually are not correct. The evidence suggests he was actually born in Réunion, an island near Madagascar off the east coast of Africa. So there was just a lot of misinformation out there, but it was misinformation that Duchaillou actually kind of helped spread during his lifetime because he was trying to sort of obscure his past and hide his past because he was mingling in with all of these, like the Royal Geographical Society and the Royal Society in London. He needed to kind of to present himself as someone who fit in those groups, and he always kind of hid his African ancestry.
And as a result of this fudging of his past and present, do you think that's the reason why Duchaillou isn't an instantly recognizable name as one of the great explorers of the Victorian era?
There are a couple of reasons. That's definitely one of them. Another reason is that during his lifetime, he wanted to be a lot of things. He wanted to be a geographer. He wanted to be a zoologist. He wanted to be an ethnographer. There were a lot of different areas he kind of dipped his toe in. He even wrote children's books. As a result, no one specialty really claimed him as his own. And so he was kind of able to slip through the cracks in that way. And then when he died, he had pretty much given away all of his possessions to various, entities, museums, or to individuals. And so nobody collected his correspondence, for example. He died with an estate valued at less than $500. So there's no place where a researcher could go and see, for example, his collected letters. They were just sort of scattered. So it became difficult to actually research him in the years after his death.
And between Man and Beast, An Unlikely Explorer, The Evolution Debates and the African Invention That Took the World by Storm is published by Random House. Monty Real, its author, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Time now on Monocle 24 for some music. Appropriately enough, this is Dirty Harry by Gorillaz. From the 2005 album Demon Days, that was Gorillaz and Dirty Harry. Stay with us here on Monocle 24. We go antique shopping in just a moment.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino
Arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, where the time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, every Friday we go to meet our neighbours. This week we head to our New York office, where our team went to visit Dienst and Dotter on Lafayette Street. It combines a minimal environment with a collection of Scandinavian antiques, paintings and objects from the 17th century to the mid-20th century. It's a reflection of Jill Dienst's passionate collecting. She has an inventory of more than 5,000 pieces and her desire to present each piece in a sculptural but youthful way. Rothko-inspired panels line the white brick walls of the space, which change constantly to create an element of surprise every time you visit.
The space itself is an old factory from the 19th century with wonderful loft-like high ceilings, very minimal in its appearance, with light floors, typical of Scandinavian manor homes, and a very pure minimalist environment with remnants of old factory cast iron columns that are all painted white as well. And it's filled with Scandinavian antiques from Baroque to mid-20th century with a few living artists as well. I have to say that every piece that I own and that I have here, I absolutely love because I only buy what I love and what I fall in love with. Pieces have to speak to me and I buy with my heart much more than my head. As I look around, I have pieces that range over so many centuries that it's hard to pick a favorite. But each one has a special place personally, especially for the moment of the find. For example, there's a wonderful corner cabinet straight from a manor house in Sweden that has its original 18th century paint and has never been touched and came directly from the manor house. And I remember the moment of purchase and that excitement being in Sweden and just finding this wonderful find. We started collecting Scandinavian antiques, which I find and found more refreshing and youthful, and I am a minimalist at heart. They've always spoken to me, they still do speak to that minimalist aesthetic that is appealing to me. I personally have worked with John Pawson on my own homes, so the connection of minimalism and the pared-down simplicity and purity of Scandinavian antiques, but also culture, is what interests me on a level that it moves my soul, truly. It's funny because it took me 9 months after moving from Sag Harbor to New York City to find the space because I want it to be a destination. I think there's something very exciting when you visit a city and actually experience something that you don't expect to experience. So it was a really difficult decision choosing a neighborhood, and then the space became available and I can't imagine being anywhere else because it's just perfect in that I'm a destination, yet I'm very convenient to get to by subway or, you know, going uptown, downtown. It's a very convenient neighborhood for people, yet it's still very boutique-y. It's a bit like Soho was in the 70s, I think, in that you have very chic skateboard shops next to some of the best restaurants in the world and galleries like my own, all together on one street in something that's becoming called NoHo, you know, north of Houston, basically. But it's really becoming an interesting neighborhood unto itself, and it's slowly revealing itself. This whole neighborhood started elevating itself, yet it still has its own personality, which is what interests me a lot. I have a wonderful clientele that's been following me for 25 plus years. Now I'm dating myself a bit, but it's true, and they're loyal and they're wonderful. Yet I have to say that this location has truly exceeded my expectations in the first year tenfold. The most interesting people of all walks of life have walked through the doors, and from artists to filmmakers to just a very interesting eclectic group that's coming in that was surprising to me, and it shows the pulse of the neighborhood that there's something interesting going on here by who's walking through the doors. So even if they're just coming to enjoy the experience or they're coming to shop, it doesn't matter to me because it is about the experience. Otherwise I would be selling on the internet, which I don't. What I've done is I've created a very minimal shell to highlight my pieces as I see them from Baroque through, let's say, mid-20th century in Denmark in the mid-century. I've created a white shell. I painted all the old bricks white, and everything's painted pure white with a white lye type of pine floor. And then each piece becomes highlighted and becomes sculptural unto themselves. So you're seeing Gustavian pieces mixed with Rococo chandeliers. I'm staring at a beautiful bench made out of wood under a very early Rococo chandelier. And that high-low mixture is what interests me a lot. And that also speaks about the neighborhood as well, if that makes any sense. I always joke that people come and they buy one piece and then it becomes an addiction, which is true. It's what happened to me, and I'm always teaching. People come, and I think it's very important to teach about a region that very little is taught in the American schools, for sure, about Scandinavia. And people do need to know about original 18th century paint versus just a painted piece. And if they are buying a repainted piece, they should know it's repainted. So the art historian in me wants to impart that information to the public. And that is really my goal. And that comes across. So anyone who visits the gallery will get a lesson in Scandinavian art and antiques, or they can just wander about themselves and enjoy it on their own, because I'm one of those people who does like to do that. I am the client too, and I always put myself in their shoes. So they can get an art, full art history dissertation on Scandinavian antiques, or they can just quietly wander.
Jill Dienst from Dienst & Dotter there on Lafayette Street. Time now on Midori House for our daily monologue. Today we turn to Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister, who reflects on his childhood fascination with cruise ships and laments the demise of luxury liners.
As a boy, I used to peer out the porthole of my father's fishing boat and gaze longingly at the bright cruise ships as they sailed by in the night. To me, they meant something great, something mysterious. Portals to the world, I used to think. While at dock, these steel behemoths poured passengers down gangways and into the streets of my small Alaskan town. Tourists filled the streets with their accents, fashion, and faces from around the globe. For a brief moment each day, the city of 30,000 was transformed into an international crossroads. To me, it was like the world came to visit for a day. My fascination with transport was apparent from a young age. While cars weren't really my thing, I could usually tell you which cruise line each ship belonged to before even seeing the name on the bow. What I also remember is when all the ships from my childhood vanished. The Pacific Princess, the original love boat, was sold off and stripped of her livery. A newer ship now bears the name, the Icon, is gone. With the exception of a few cruise lines, the era of exclusive luxury cruising has slowly faded. Replacing it? A cruise culture of deep discounts and the idea that a cruise can be every man's holiday. Staterooms and all-you-can-eat meals are cheap for most voyages. Realizing volume and not quality is the key, cruise lines have managed to build ships that barely fit through the Panama Canal. They've also a reputation for attracting passengers that barely fit up the gangway. It seems the last year has been a particularly bad one for cruising around the globe. When the Costa Concordia rolled over off the coast of Italy, people lost their lives. Last month, the Carnival Triumph lost power. While no one was injured, passengers were left to their own primal devices in order to survive. Reports of leaking sewage and ketchup sandwiches for 5 days made for some angry cruisers. What followed each incident were media frenzies. The idea of thousands of people paying to be stranded in their own filth is an odd sort of tale, but it makes for great television. All of this seems the antithesis to my childhood dreams of world-class cruising. The need for cruise lines to beef up the bottom line and do so fast has meant each new ship is bigger than the last. When was the last time you truly said that a nice holiday would involve being slammed into closed quarters with 4,500 strangers and in a stateroom that has no window? But you get what you pay for, and I think that's the biggest point here. The fallout from these disaster cruises has been a bit frustrating. While some people claim to have been stripped of their dignity, I would argue they need to take a hard look at exactly where their dignity was lost. If midnight chocolate buffets, all-you-can-eat pizza parties, and Mai Tais are what make you tick, then I think we, as a society, need to look at dignity as a whole. Maybe we should remind ourselves that boarding a big ship used to mean you were headed for a new world, with better opportunity. And no matter how bad the food and the services were, you still got your dignity in the end. Cruising should survive. In theory, it's a wonderful way to see the world. In a place like Southeast Alaska's Inside Passage, it is vital to the economy. And getting people close to nature may make them think more about saving nature in the end. I just think we could all benefit from a good look at the voyage ahead. Quality shouldn't ever be compromised when the safety of thousands of people is at stake. While life on my father's fishing boat seemed boring compared to the pageantry on these big ships, I've come to realize that for now, the spectacle across the water might be best observed from a distance. For Monocle 24 in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
That's all we have time for today's program. My thanks to our producers, Tom Edwards and Alid John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Annabelle Bly, our studio manager too, Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is The Menu. Your host for that, Marcus Hippie. And myself and Andrew Muller will be back for the Monocle Daily in 2 hours' time. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.